Folks, we want to welcome you all to On the Edge with K.A. Owens. I'm K.A. Owens, and we're broadcasting on Forward Radio, WFMP-LP Louisville, 106.5 FM. And if you want to find out a little bit more about us, you can go to forwardradio.org. And as a matter of fact, if you go to that website, because we are streaming now, you can hear us, listen to us anywhere in the world. So, folks, we're very, very lucky to have with us today Professor Ariana Levinson, who's a professor at the University of Louisville Law School. She teaches labor law, and she's the co-author of the recent article in Leo, Unions Punch Back, by Ariana Levinson and Devon Oser. So, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Kay. Thank you for having me.
So there were several topics mentioned in the article, but one of those was right to work. So tell us something about right to work. What does it mean? And what does it mean for labor? And what does it mean for all of us?
So right to work is really a misnomer. It really doesn't give people rights, and it doesn't give people work. When you're trying to understand what right to work is, you need to have a little bit of background about unions and about union security. So in general, there's an act, the National Labor Relations Act. It governs private sector workers, so non-government workers in the United States. And these workers have a right to join a union. They have a right not to join a union. When the majority of workers vote that they would like to have a union, then the union's required to represent everybody, whether they're a member of this union or not. And somebody who's not a member can elect to only pay a certain amount of money to the union. And that is the amount of money that covers collective bargaining and that covers filing grievances and going to arbitrations. So under the law, no one can be required to join a union or to pay anything more than their fair share. But the NLRA has a section in it, Section 14, that allows states to pass what are called these right-to-work laws. And effectively what these do is they enable those who are not members of the union, even though the majority in that workplace has voted to have a union, to pay nothing. So they're basically not paying their fair share. They're able to free ride. They're able to have the representation of the union, just the same as a full dues paying member. And they're able to do this without paying a penny. And so at the bottom of it, that's what right to work is. Some people might argue that, well, it's someone's right not to have to pay money to the union, but the way that right can be satisfied is to go to a different workplace. In the private sector right now, only 7% are unionized. So the great majority, 93% of places you can go to work, you don't need to join the union or pay anything to the union. So when the majority of employees have voted for this and they want to have a union, people should be required to pay what is necessary to keep the collective bargaining for the higher wages, the better benefits, the job security in place.
So now Kentucky, a southern state, but for many years was one of the last southern states that did not have right to work.
Yes.
Legislation, but just recently, was it this year or last year?
2017. It was the first legislation that the new Republican House and Senate passed, and that was approved by Governor Bevin. And recently we have seen some other states like Michigan and Indiana adopt right-to-work statutes, but we also saw just a month ago in Missouri that resoundingly two-thirds of people, when given the chance to vote, voted against right-to-work of the electorate in Missouri.
So upside or downside for labor. That is, so right to work is thought of as a negative for labor. Because in general, it sort of reduces the standard of living for working people. So tell us about as far as the legal system is concerned, a little bit about how the power of labor has sort of risen and decreased over time. Is there a time frame perspective on that?
Yes, definitely. So the National Labor Relations Act, the original Wagner Act, named after the Senator Wagner, passed in 1935. And after its passage, you saw a growth in unions, and unions were very strong. They were able to strike, and not only strike against their own employer, but to hold industry-wide strikes. They had a lot of power. They were able to represent the workers, that the union really is made up of the workers, and so they were using their numbers to do that. So in the 40s, some of the employers or more conservative people in the country became concerned, and in 1947, they passed what we know as the Taft-Hartley Act. Part of that amended the National Labor Relations Act. It took away the right to what we call secondary boycott, so it more limited the right to strike more. It added the provisions that permit people not to join the union, as well as to be able to join the union. And it made other changes that are generally seen as detrimental to labor. And since the 40s, we have seen a steady decline in the private sector in the percentage of workplaces that are union. And so we're now down below 7% in the private sector. Now, in the public sector, where the laws are adopted state by state, locality by locality, the rate has been higher. It's around 30%.
So just as a note for our folk out there, the rise of what we think of as the middle class in America had a lot to do with the power of labor and to create enough income for ordinary people that they could become homeowners and send their kids to college and create what we think of as the middle class lifestyle. That is, the majority of the middle class for many years was a sort of a blue collar middle class, where you had one person, for instance, working at International Harvest or General Motors, who could make enough money to support the nuclear family that became so well known for 30 or 40 years. And then when the power of the unions waned, it became much more difficult to attain and maintain what we call middle class status. So what's the prognosis? I mean, the title of the article is Unions Punch Back. Of course, you were telling me that you didn't create the headline, but so what does that mean?
So Keith Stone, who's one of the editors at Leo, really wanted to focus on the fact of unions being proactive and taking action, and that's part of why he titled the piece in this way. And this piece is specific to Kentucky and action that unions here in Kentucky are taking, and they filed a suit, the Zuckerman suit, and it's pending right now in front of the Kentucky Supreme Court. And in this suit, the unions argue that there are a number of bases upon which the Kentucky right to work statute should be found unconstitutional, so that Kentucky would not be able to adopt right to work if the Supreme Court found that. So that is one way that unions are being proactive in the state. But there are other ways, not only in this state, but in other states, that unions are being proactive. And basically, many studies suggest that right to work and the lower union density cause lower wages. They correlate with lower wages. And so unions historically have been groups of people coming together in large numbers to push for better working conditions. And although we may conceive of them as some external entity, at heart, they are really the workers in the particular workplace. And so to the extent that people can foster solidarity and do internal organizing, they are able to convince people, despite what the law might say, of the importance of the union. And what you've been talking about, KA, how that is, if the union density can go up, that can correlate with a rising tide for all. Not only those in the union workplaces, but other non-union workplaces will match those benefits if they if there is a high enough union density that companies are paying decent wages, paying decent benefits, then even the non-union companies will bring their wages and benefits up to that level. So unions have been proactive not only through the law and filing the lawsuit, but also in their what we call internal organizing strategies. And so there's, just to say, there's more than one way that unions are being proactive about what's happening. For me, a large part of the problem is the law. And so no matter how much effort unions and working people make, it can be difficult to make a lot of progress with the current law. For instance, employees are guaranteed the right to strike. It's explicitly mentioned in the National Labor Relations Act, but anytime you go out on economic strike, an employer can permanently replace you. Well, people aren't going to want to strike if they can be permanently replaced. So there's certain barriers in the law that no matter how proactive labor or the working people are, unless we can elect officials at the state level and at the federal level who will make changes to the laws and support working people, you know, we're going to come against these legal barriers.
And so from an economic point of view, we're being told that the economy is booming, and it's only booming for some people at the very, very top. Still ordinary people just don't have enough money in their pockets to buy things that society has the ability to produce. And, of course, wages are still flat. I mean, in reality, effectively, America hasn't had a raise for 30 years. I mean, that is a big, big problem. That is a we had this economic expansion from the 40s to the late 70s, and wages rose along with productivity. A lot of that had to do with the power of the unions. But then after that, the companies and corporations really started pushing back against labor, and it's really hurt the ability of people to hand down wealth to their children and for people to achieve what's called a middle-class lifestyle, what's called, what people think of, or even be comfortable, and have more than a few dollars in the bank. I mean, they just did a special yesterday on public television, I think it's Frontline Dayton, Ohio. Had a GM plant, a lot of unionized workers. The plants left, and there's some manufacturing coming back, but they're starting people off at, $15 an hour. And it's impossible. Even if you have two people making that, nobody has any money in the bank. Nobody has any economic security, and nobody has any future.
In my opinion, and my opinions and what I say here aren't reflective of the University of Louisville or the law school's opinions. They are my personal opinions. Since we have a cyclical economy, we need to work to have different forms of business that don't go with the booms and busts. Because in addition to basically having you know, stagnant or decreasing wages, given that they haven't gone up as fast as the cost of living has, like you just mentioned. So in addition to that, in addition to now, it's always been seen as those in a union workplace were a little more privileged than those outside of a union workplace. And now with so many fewer inside the union workplace, there's less of an effect of other places raising their wages and benefits up. So you know, those two components that you've mentioned are part of that problem. And then, you know, part of that problem is that when the economy goes back down, which it will, because that's how our economy works, it goes in cycles, is that the people who are employed right now will no longer be employed. And so they can't, even if they could save, which they can't, right, they cannot possibly save enough to deal with a downturn in the economy. So I'm very interested in, obviously very interested in changes to the law that increase unionization so that we can help people earn those living wages. And I wanted to mention, this is kind of off point, but especially for people of color, when you look at how much more a person of color in a union makes compared to a person of color not in a union, there's really a significant difference there. And so unions have become much more diverse, much more integrated. And there's always historically been Black unions, but so unions are really a force for equity, racial and class equity, in my opinion, and that we need to think of things that are businesses that are owned by the people and owned by the community so that they can better weather those downturns. So you're not going to have all unionized businesses, but you might have a mix of unionized businesses and smaller businesses that are owned by the workers. You could have both worker-owned and union-represented.
So this is community-based co-ops. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. So part of my scholarship focuses on what are known as union cooperatives, and those are owned by the workers, and the workers are also represented by a union. They're a small portion of our economy right now, but they're growing. And Dayton is at, you mentioned Dayton, and Dayton is actually one of the places where they're looking at cooperatives as a solution to some of the, you know, loss of income that's happening.
So one of the issues that's going on now here in Louisville, I mean, Black leaders in Louisville are being told that there are plenty of jobs. It's just that Black people aren't trained for the job. That's what they're being told. And, you know, traditionally, when an industry creates a job, it takes on the responsibility of training people to do the job. That's the way it's been done for, you know, 100 years. Of course, the unions had apprenticeship programs to train people to do certain types of work. So one of the things that if we had the co-ops, it could be that the co-ops could make sure that people were trained for the jobs that were available.
Yeah, so there's a wonderful book called Collective Courage that Jessica Gordon Emhart, who's an economist at City University in New York, wrote. And she documents the practice and the history of cooperative economics in the Black community. And honestly, part of the reason we don't know some of it is because of the violence against people of color, that they couldn't risk letting it known publicly that they were joining together to have ownership in businesses. So this is definitely something that there's a history of, and many cooperatives have training as a component of what they're doing. So they're training people not only in the jobs, but in life skills, right? How do you balance the fact that you're the sole breadwinner, but you're also solely responsible for the children or the elderly people in your home, right? So co-ops can make it a part of their business to actually help people with that type of thing. That's what they've done in Cleveland with the Evergreen Cooperatives. And then they can give you training as well on financial literacy. And they do this because you're an owner, and so you need to be able to understand how the business operates to contribute to making sure that it's running and that it's making a living, you know, an amount that can give you and your coworkers a living. So it's an integral part of the cooperative model is really to have education and training. If you even go down to, you know, back to the original cooperative principles, education is one of those principles. So I certainly don't think cooperatives are like some panacea that's the solution to the whole problem. We definitely need, you know, we need affordable education that people can afford that provides skills training in the areas that there are jobs. We need the companies to take that on as, you know, they don't need to make so much profit. They could spend part of it, like you've suggested, towards training their entry-level hires. So we need, you know, we need our education system to do this. We need our businesses to do this. And community ownership can be a small part of this, too, where it's being done in the business.
So, so what brought you to this field of study?
So, I've obviously thought about that because I need to connect with my students and with others that I work with. So if I were to think about it quickly, my father actually lost his job when I was in high school, and I think that had an impact on me and motivated me to be interested in ways that people could have job security. I grew up in the Detroit area, so it makes sense that I would be interested in unions as a way of obtaining job security and just more equality in our economy. And I just found I had that wonderful opportunity to go to college and to study political economics and to be surrounded with people active in the union movement. And it is something that I really like. I can devote my life and my career to it. I love teaching my students about labor law. I've been very fortunate.
So, so when you look at Kentucky compared to the rest of the country, how do you compare? I mean, you're most recently from California. So how do you compare? How are we doing?
Well, you know, I think right now the majority of the country is right to work, right? So we're not different in that respect. There are other places in the West, on the East Coast, that aren't right to work. They've also had more success with living wage ordinances. You'll know that Louisville and Kentucky did pass living wage ordinances, but they were found by our Kentucky Supreme Court to be preempted by our state minimum wage, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that, I personally don't think the union movement here is as vibrant as it is in a place like Los Angeles, where there's a very big grassroots, diverse, people are energized in the union movement. But I don't think that Kentucky is the worst. I think it's in line, actually, unfortunately, with the majority of the country.
So how are the students that are coming up, are they familiar with labor law or the history of labor law, or is it sort of foreign territory for them when you speak with them about these issues?
Right. So it's very mixed. I do like that being at the University of Louisville, we do have a number of students who may be first generation students who are from union families. Definitely a higher percentage than when I taught at several more elite law schools where they did not have that background. So I really love that about teaching at the University of Louisville. But there are, of course, the segment that just don't have familiarity with it. And even those who may be from a union family may not really understand the labor laws. They may know, you know, my dad had a good wage and I'm able to come here because of the union, but they may not know that, well, yeah, you have the right to strike, but you can be permanently replaced if it's an economic strike. The level of detail of the law wouldn't be familiar to them. A lot of people don't even realize outside of the union context that the baseline in the U.S. other than Montana and Puerto Rico is that you're employed at will. So you can be terminated for any reason or no reason at all. Whereas when you have a union, they negotiate a clause so that you can only be terminated for good cause. And in employment law, very few of my students coming in realize this. We, of course, know this by the time we get out of the class.
So, folks, you are listening to On the Edge with K.A. Owens. I'm K.A. Owens, and we're speaking with Professor Ariana Levinson of the University of Louisville Law School. She teaches labor law, and she is the co-author of the recent article in Leo. It was the August 29th, 2018 Leo. Unions Punch Back by Ariana Levinson and Devon Oser. So be sure to check out the article. And there was an author you mentioned as being worth reading, and that was Jessica, who wrote Collective Courage?
Yes, Jessica Gordon Nemhart. She's at City University of New York. She's an economist there. She's written a really groundbreaking book. It is dense, but it's definitely worth reading. And if you can't read it, you can download her YouTube videos. It's definitely worth hearing from her. She came here about 2 years ago and spoke at the main library and at the law school, and it was really worth hearing her.
Wonderful, wonderful. So, so folks, you've got no excuse for checking it out. With the YouTube video, you can check it out on your smartphone at your leisure. So, so unions are fighting back. Do you have a sort of a positive feel about what's going on in Kentucky now?
Well, I think you always need to hold out hope. We started Devon Oser, my co-author, who's an amazing young union side attorney, and I started our piece with our quotation from Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. He was able, you know, many decades ago to fight off right to work in Oklahoma. We see it being fought off in Missouri. We can hold out hope that the Supreme Court here in Kentucky will strike it down. And even if that's not the case, we can hope that people will go to the polls and will elect representatives and senators and a governor who support working people and who support unionization. And for me, I can't give up on that hope, or that would be defeat. And I also think the people leading our unions are very creative and smart, and they will do internal organizing, and they will figure out ways for people to be able to advocate for better working conditions.
Folks, we've been very, very lucky to be here today with Professor Ariana Levinson. Thank you so much.
Thank you.